advisor for Park Avenue Securities, LLC. 7 Hanover Square, New York, New York, 10004. Securities products, services, and advisory services are offered through Park Avenue Securities, a registered broker-dealer and investment advisor. 888-600-4667. Financial representative, The Guardian Life Insurance Company of America, New York, New York. Park Avenue Securities is an indirect, wholly owned subsidiary of The Guardian Life Insurance Company of America. Wealth Strategy Partners is not an affiliate or subsidiary of Park Avenue Securities or The Guardian Life Insurance Company of America. Park Avenue Securities is a member of FINRA SIPC.
Hawaii's Business Authority, KGU, Honolulu.
Part of the Wall Street Business Network.
Covering the financial and business news you need to know.
With SRN News, I'm Keith Peters in Washington. Senator Daniel Inouye, the second longest-serving U.S. senator, has died of respiratory complications. As SRN's Linda Kenney reports, his colleagues took swift action to replace him in one of his top roles.
Senator Inouye, who was 88, was also president pro tem of the Senate, and as such was the third in the line of presidential succession after the vice president and the Speaker of the House. That's why the Senate had to move quickly to replace Inouye in that role. By unanimous consent, the Senate voted to elect Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy to serve as president pro tem. The action by the Senate was taken just about an hour after the news broke of Senator Inouye's death.
Under Hawaii law, the governor of the state will appoint a successor to Inouye until a special election can be held. Also at SRNNews.com, questions about the mind of the murderer in the Sandy Hook Elementary School massacre continue to be asked. Dr. Alan Lipman with the Center for the Study of Violence says research shows many of the shooters in mass killings have some kind of mental illness.
They lose contact with reality. They become paranoid. They believe that people are out to get them. We saw this with Cho in the Virginia Tech shooting, who also was psychotic and paranoid, treated and then turned away.
Adam Lanza's parents reportedly were concerned about his behavior. Just under a third of voters turned out for the first stage of the referendum on a constitution meant to be a historic milestone in setting Egypt's future, a showing critics say deepens doubts over the legitimacy of a charter that has already polarized the country. The dismal showing also raises the question whether Egyptians have been turned off by the turmoil that's characterized the country's politics throughout the nearly 2 years since the ouster of Hosni Mubarak. On Wall Street, the Dow up by 100 points to 13,235. The NASDAQ rose 39. The S&P advanced 17. Oil up to $87.20 a barrel. This is SRN News.
You see and hear ad after ad about owning gold, but they raise more questions than they answer. That's why American Bullion has created a comprehensive free gold guide packed with unbiased information about gold as an investment. Get the facts before you buy. Call American Bullion now for your free copy of the gold guide at 800-456-7475. That's 800-456-7475. Are you tired of stressing out about the economy and ready to take control of your retirement funds? American Bullion has a precise, tax-free, and hassle-free system to convert your existing IRA or former 401k into a gold IRA. That's why they're the leader in gold IRA rollovers. It's all spelled out in the free American Bullion Gold Guide that answers all of your questions in plain and simple English. Call for your free copy today at 800-456-7475. That's 800-456-7475. American Bullion. 800-456-7475.
Hi, this is Danny Yamashiro with a slice of the good life. Joe Onosai was drafted by the Dallas Cowboys before an injury ended his career. He opens up about what drove him as an athlete.
You know, I was just so mad because I wanted my dad to be proud of me. And so, you know, I would be the last one to leave the weight room, the last one off the field. I would just go to great lengths just so I can get my dad to say, I'm proud of you. And if he did, and great disappointment, great rejection, again, the cycle will start over again. And it seemed like in every relationship I had, you know, if I didn't get the approval or affirmation from that person, you know, I'd fall into deep depression.
Joe Onosai found wholeness when he received the affirmation he longed for in Jesus Christ. He became a finalist in the World's Strongest Man competition and is a global communicator of hope. He's one of the most encouraging men I know. I believe it's because Pastor Joe has heard the Lord say in Jeremiah 31:3, I have loved you with an everlasting love. I have drawn you with loving kindness. The Lord says to you, I see you. I love you. I'm proud of you.
Share this encouragement. Get free podcasts and a free book from Danny at goodlifeslice.com. Connect with Danny Yamashiro on Facebook and Twitter. A slice of the good life, providing 90 seconds of refreshing hope for you to share. Visit goodlifeslice.com. A slice of the good life is a program of Danny Yamashiro Ministries in Honolulu, Hawaii.
Aloha, Jeff Davis, the solar guy here. A breath of fresh air is what you need on your afternoon drive home, not the boring windbags. Can I say that? Tune in Monday through Friday. That's Hawaii's Tomorrow, 5 to 6 p.m., 760 KGU. Aloha.
Jeff Davis, the Solar Guy, presents Hawaii's Tomorrow, a series of discussions about Hawaii's business future, led by experts in their respective fields. Today's contributing host is the man himself, Jeff Davis, the Solar Guy.
Died today, as you well know, heard anything on the news. The last words spoken of all. I'd like to have a moment, perhaps a few seconds of silence in memory of our Senator Obama. Aloha. There's not a long enough moment of silence to show respect for somebody who worked themselves to death the way he did. I know he enjoyed his work. And we all want to say thank you, give our great feelings to his family and whatnot. Tomorrow's show, we'll be dealing with that. We'll have some guests in here talking about Senator's life, what his contributions. We'll also be looking at the after effects, which, as I heard Governor Abercrombie today say, they would come in due time, as well they should. Many times in your life, what you thought was important 5 minutes ago suddenly looks a bit trivial. In this case, I would say that fits the bill in the sense that this man's a historical story, by all means. Whereas today, we're going to be discussing marine biology. And I know that it sounds somewhat different or left field, but you're going to find out from my co-host, Carly Weiner. Carly, are you with me today?
Right here, Jeff. How you doing?
Aloha. And, you know, a tough introduction for your show today, say the least. But I think that people are going to be surprised how much Senator Noya's life did revolve around your subject matter that you're going to talk to about today. And that's going to be marine conservation and just the Juliana of what's right and what's pono for everybody, generations to come. How are you today, Carly?
I'm doing all right. The traffic out here is pretty crazy, but I'm doing well otherwise.
All right. Well, you have a great show. And like I said, I'll be having a show tomorrow with some guests talking about it, Mr. Inouye, Senator Inouye, as well as what the options are for the Democratic Party, etc. In the meantime, the word, last word spoken by this great man. The word that we say every day on this show and remind people that it's more than a word. It's a complete life. It encompasses everything, including death. And I want to say aloha to Senator Inouye as well. Carly, have a great show and aloha.
Aloha, Jeff. And what a fitting theme today, Marine Mammal Heroes. We've had Senator Inouye pass, and he was definitely a marine conservation hero for us. Was very supportive of marine issues, and I'm very happy to acknowledge our guest today that we have, Dr. Lars Bider, Dr. Dave Johnston, Dr. Michelle Barbieri, and Krista Graham. How are you guys doing there this morning?
We're doing great. Hey, Carly.
Yeah, we're great. Thanks, Carly.
Thanks, guys. Sorry about all the chaos today. Been trying to get into the studio, and many of you, I'm sure, listening are stuck in traffic as well. So what I would like to do is I'd like to start with Michelle this evening and chat a little bit about what you've been doing with the Monk Seal program. Dr. Michelle Barbieri is a veterinarian with NOAA Fisheries and has been instrumental in a lot of marine mammal rescue, particularly with monk seal in the last 6 weeks. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Actually, some of the listeners may be familiar with her story. Her name, we refer to her as R5AY, and a lot of the folks on the North Shore that see her regularly have named her Honey Girl. And her story was in the press a few times, but she's a seal that is an adult female. We know that in her history, she's had at least 7 pups in that area, and she had recently weaned her most recent pup just a month prior to us finding her on November 14th, where we found a hook in her cheek. And so thanks to the surveillance that we have out in that area, which is provided by a lot of volunteers from the Hawaiian Monk Seal Response Team Oahu, we were able to find her within a few days of that report and go ahead and assess her on the beach. Unfortunately, she was very, very thin. She probably had been hooked 2 or 3 weeks before these initial photographs came in. And because her body weight was low after weaning her pup, she likely didn't get a chance to go out and replenish her body stores. So we elected to bring her into rehabilitation at the Waikiki Aquarium.
And how's she doing now, Michelle?
Well, she's actually doing all right. We released her just about 2.5 weeks ago, and even though we released her still a little on the thin side, we decided that it was better for her and her recovery to go ahead and continue eating and gaining weight back out in the wild. We did get a chance to go take a really close look at her last Wednesday. We had some concerns. She seemed like maybe she was a little lethargic and wasn't responding to onlookers by jumping into the water like we would want her to. So we went out and we restrained her, and we were able to do an exam. We were able to look at her body fat stores. We also got a blood sample and gave her another dose of antibiotics just to be safe. But we think she is gaining some weight, and so that's really encouraging. She still has quite a ways to go in her recovery. She's still quite thin. Her blood work showed that she does have a high white blood cell count, which means that she's probably fighting off some sort of infectious process. Whether it's due to the surgery that was done on her tongue or whether it was something else that might be going on, we're not entirely sure. But the good news is that she looked bright. She was hydrated. We feel confident that she's out there eating, and we're hopeful that she's going to continue to recover out there in the wild.
Now, that surgery that you mentioned, that tongue surgery, that was the first time that had ever been done. How did it feel to be involved with that?
Well, it was a hugely collaborative effort. The way that we go about doing that type of a response for a monk seal here on Oahu right now is with the involvement of a lot of local partners. As I said before, she was housed at the Waikiki Aquarium in one of their rehabilitation pools. But in order to go and take her into surgery, we called upon our partners at the Honolulu Zoo. And they have a surgical suite where we have an anesthesia machine, and they provided a lot of additional support for that procedure. We also called in a local surgeon and another local veterinarian for their assistance. And the veterinary surgeon was the one who provided the reconstructive surgery on her tongue that was essential for her continued survival. It was absolutely fascinating to be alongside of him while he was performing that procedure. She lost at least a third to a half of her tongue in this incident. And at that point in time, you know, we were just giving her the best chance we could. We weren't at that time completely confident that it would be enough for her to be able to ever eat again. But we were fortunate that she was. And it's in great thanks to all of those partners, as well as a lot of the support we've received from the Marine Mammal Center back in Sausalito, California. And the Marine Mammal Center is an organization which is helping us to provide more support for instances like this. And they're actually building a facility in Kona over on the Big Island for monk seal rehabilitation.
Now, Michelle, what kind of decision-making is involved in selecting marine mammals or monk seals to take into rehabilitation? I mean, that's got to be a process.
It's certainly not one that we take lightly. When you bring an animal into rehabilitation, you really are assuming a lot of responsibility. But because Hawaiian monk seals are so critically endangered, there's just about 1,100 monk seals remaining. And particularly in a very small population, it's the adult females that are the more important ones with respect to breeding. So with this particular individual, we pulled out all the stops and we really wanted to do everything we possibly could. So once we got on the beach and assessed her situation that very first day, we were pretty sure that rehabilitation was the thing that needed to happen, because if we hadn't been able to bring her in, she absolutely would have perished from this injury.
It sounds like you guys are doing amazing work, and thanks to you and your team, we have one more monk seal that looks like it's going to make a full recovery. Why don't we take a quick traffic break, and when we come back, we will talk to Krista Graham about some of her marine mammal work.
KGU,
part of the Wall Street Business Network.
Traffic's back to normal. If you're going to the windward side, there were accidents earlier. No problems to Hawaii Kai. Coming in from the east is slow. The H1 Evabound slows at UH, and it's very slow from there to the downtown stretch. Going west, the H1 slows at the east end of the airport viaduct. The Moanalua slows right after Middle Street. And we have one new accident. This one's on Farrington Highway, leeward coast, Ma'aloa Street in Nanakuli.
The sun is the root source of energy in food, fossil fuels, and wind energy. The clearest use of the sun's energy is solar power. BanQ Solar brings to Hawaii a technological breakthrough that maximizes the power from each solar module. With our AC Unison system, BanQ Solar's AC Unison modules have microinverters on each module that converts DC electricity to AC electricity, allowing your system to produce 5 to 25% more power than other solar systems. It's cost-effective, has a 25-year warranty, and an attractive all-black design. The AUO BenQ Solar Company is one of the most trusted companies in the solar industry. With state and federal incentives in place and utility rates going up, now is the time to generate your own electricity with a beautiful BenQ solar system. It looks great, produces more power than standard solar systems, and saves you money in the process. Call 554-7200 for your local BenQ solar installer and enjoy your savings now.
280,000 acres. That's the size of Molokai, Lanai, and Kahoolawe put together. It's also the amount of the prime farmable ag land designated in Hawaii. 280,000 acres. That's a lot of prime farmable ag land, and it needs to be preserved for agriculture. Aloha, I'm Dean Okimoto of Nalo Farms, and this fact is brought to you by Ho'opili, a new community where commercial farms, neighborhood, and home gardens will be part of the community's design. And there's so much more. Log on to www.ho'opilioahu.com.
Aloha, it's Jeff. Is it hotter in your home than out on your lanai? Do you wish there was an energy-efficient way to cool down? Wouldn't it be nice to turn on the trays at the flip of a switch? Well, my friends at Island Cooling have been quietly promoting the energy-efficient whole house fan for years. It works by drawing fresh air through your home, pushing the hot air out through your attic. Call the Whole House Fan experts at Island Cooling, 672-2300, 672-2300, or go to islandcooling.com. Aloha.
If you would like to join Jeff Davis and his guests on the air, call now at 296-5467. That's 296-5467. Now back to the Solar Guy.
You're listening to Hawaii's Tomorrow with Jeff Davis, the Solar Guy.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal, filling in for Jeff Davis. Thank goodness I got here now. Traffic is seeming to be dispersed. And with us now is Krista Graham. Krista is an endangered species biologist for NOAA Fisheries, Pacific Islands Regional Office. She is currently working on responding to a number of petitions to list species either as threatened or endangered, and recently has been working with false killer whales. So first off, Krista, why don't you tell us what makes the false killer whale so special? Why list it and not other whale species?
Thanks, Carly. That's a great question. Well, this species is actually found globally in warm and temperate waters, but there's actually three different stocks or populations found in Hawaii, and that includes the main Hawaiian Islands insular population, the pelagic population, and a population found up in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands. And since we just listed the main Hawaiian Islands insular population as endangered, there's a few things that are special about this. One, this species is, the population size is very small. There's only about 150 individuals. And a number of other reasons, there are many reasons, but one in particular is that this species is genetically distinct from all other false killer whales found worldwide. So because the population is so small and declining, we felt that it deserved being protected by the Endangered Species Act.
What does that mean, genetically distinct, for our non-marine science listeners?
So genetically distinct means that they aren't breeding with other false killer whales. Those found in the pelagic population, in which their range overlaps, or false killer whales anywhere else. So, you know, with only 150, there can be such... there are such threats as inbreeding can happen with so few species. So, you know, there are a number of concerns with this small population.
And because the population is so small, what other threats are you all concerned with?
Well, we convened a number of scientists from NOAA Fisheries to do a status review of the species. And they determined, the scientists determined that there were 29 potential threats to false killer whales. And of the 29, there are 15 that are considered to be significant. And these include anthropogenic noise, climate change, competition with fisheries, interactions with fisheries. And then there were two that were considered to be severe, and that's the small population size, such as inbreeding depression that can occur, as well as hooking and entanglement that's occurring with the fisheries in Hawaii.
So there are a lot of concerns surrounding the fisheries and the false killer whales then.
A lot of concerns.
So this listing goes into effect, as I understand, December 28th. And what exactly does that mean? What once they're listed, what will change?
Well, what this means is that U.S. citizens can't take this species, and by take, that means to harass, harm, pursue, hunt, shoot, wound, or kill this species.
That's a long list there, Krista.
It is. So it just prohibits intentional harm, harassment, things like that to the species.
So some of those terms, harassment, seem a little vague. What would harassment entail?
For example... you know, a lot of marine species here in Hawaii deal with or have to contend with, you know, swimmers and snorkelers that want to, you know, get a little bit closer. And that is, you know, it may seem fun to the person, but it's not so fun to the animal. You know, it disturbs them while they're trying to feed or rest.
And are the false killer whales, I haven't interacted too many in my lifetime in the ocean, but are they like the pilot whales where they tend to be a little bit more aggressive, or where would we typically see these whales and what would their behavior be in the water?
Well, there are fewer false killer whales than there are pilot whales, so you're not likely to see them on just sort of a random occasion because there are only 150 in the nearshore waters. But if you were to see them, you know, they would likely just be swimming along, foraging for prey. I have heard a story where, you know, they share their prey amongst their group. And there was a underwater photographer that was shooting video of false killer whales. And they had a, I think it was a tuna or mahi in their mouth. And they it's kind of like pass the potato. And they passed the fish from one whale to the next, and it was passed to the photographer, and then he passed it on to the next whale. So they're... You never know. You might see that.
Wow, pretty generous whales there. So if they, when will they become on the Endangered Species Act list, how will that differ from the Marine Mammal Protection Act? Will they will have both protections, or what is the distinction between those two?
So let's see. Both acts are federal laws to protect species, and the ESA protects endangered and threatened species, and protects animals as well as plants, both domestic and foreign species. And there are about just over 2,000 species listed under the ESA, and of those, 1,400 of them are found within the U.S., and seven of those species are marine mammals found in Hawaii. Now, the Marine Mammal Protection Act protects against take and importing marine mammals or marine mammal products into the U.S., and there are 125 listed species under the Marine Mammal the Marine Mammal Protection Act, and there are about 20 of those that are found in Hawaii.
So you're not just protecting the false killer whales; you're responsible for other species as well on that are listed within this act.
Exactly. Yeah, and so false killer whales are now going to be protected under both the Endangered Species Act as well as the Marine Mammal Protection Act.
And are there other marine species that you're working on the putting on the Endangered Species Act list?
In our region, that's the only marine species currently. We do have, we are working on responding to a number of other petitions for corals, for some fish species, but that's the only marine mammal currently.
And in your 7 years of experience working for NOAA Fisheries, are there certain animals that there are more support for than others? I mean, is there a lot of public support for putting the false killer whale on the Endangered Species Act list versus corals? Or,
you know, that's an interesting question. A lot of people do want to, you know, conserve these species, but a lot of people are concerned with what that actually means. So we are trying to really educate the public so that they understand that it doesn't mean, just because a species is listed under the ESA, it doesn't mean that, you know, you can no longer go fishing or you can no longer go surfing or swimming with these species. It doesn't mean that at all.
And going back to Michelle, who works with a threatened, critically threatened species. No, they're endangered. Okay, so an endangered species as well. Because the monk seal is an endangered species, are there certain protocols or steps you need to take before you're going out and working with these marine mammals?
Yes, absolutely. So in order for anyone to work with a protected marine mammal, which all of them are protected under the Marine Mammal Protection Act, and monk seals as well as false killer whales in Hawaii are listed as endangered. So we have to have permits in order to do that ourselves. And for us with Honey Girl, that required us actually going in and getting permissions from the folks that are in charge of those permits to do that. But we have a really good working relationship with them, and we report to them regularly with lots of updates and that sort of thing.
So to both you ladies, when our public is out on the water and they see fisheries entanglements or a monk seal with a hook, what should the average citizen do? I mean, obviously you don't want the general public approaching these animals and trying to take matters into their own hands. So how can they get help from those marine mammals that they encounter?
Well, for monk seals, you know, one of the things you just said I will certainly highlight, which is that we don't necessarily advocate for the public taking those matters into their own hands. Monk seals can certainly be quite cute and adorable at many times, but it's really an animal that can do harm. And so it's best to report and report early. One of the things that we've learned from particularly this most recent seal is that we really, really want timely reporting. As a veterinarian, as the person who was assessing her, it's critical. Those days are really important in getting to them and providing veterinary care as quick as we can.
And what about those false killer whales, Krista?
You know, it's if you notice them, the first thing to do is to call the NOAA stranding hotline if any of them are on the beach. That would be our first line of response.
And so now that they're listed, what's the next steps? What is next for the false killer whale?
Well, our next step is to consider whether or not designating critical habitat would be determinable and prudent. So what that means is, are there any geographic areas that are special enough that need some sort of management or protection for the species? So we'd look at things like, you know, where the false killer whale needs to gather food, where it needs to rest, give birth to their young, raise their young. So we would look at things like that. And regardless of whether or not we designate critical habitat, we would also develop a recovery plan for the species and then implement it in order to try to conserve the species and bring the population numbers back up.
So how do you feel now? I mean, you've been working on getting these particular animals on the Endangered Species Act list for quite some time. This has got to be a rewarding feat for you.
Yeah, it was. This petition originally came in on October 1st of 2009, so the whole process took 3 years. It's supposed to take about two, but it's just a very kind of cumbersome process. So, you know, it felt really great to be done with a huge hurdle, but, you know, the momentum needs to continue because we really need to consider critical habitat for the species and then start figuring out ways to recover this small population.
Amazing. Thank you so much for all your information today, and congratulations again on the listing. That is one big feat. So,
well, thank you.
Great work. I want to acknowledge COSI Island Earth. COSI stands for Centers for Ocean Science and Education Excellence and is an NSF-funded program with 14 centers across the U.S. It is housed at the University of Hawaii at Manoa and aims to connect marine science issues to both the visitor and local communities. For more information about marine issues, you can visit us online at www.cosi-ie.net. We're going to take a quick traffic break. I'd like to acknowledge some of our Solar Guy sponsors, R&R Solar and Rolf Christ, Corona Red, Inter-Island Solar Supply and Cully Judd, the Natural Energy Lab, Honolulu Weekly, and Sabrina's Restaurant. We'll be right back to talk about spinner dolphins.
760 KGU.
Part of the Wall Street Business Network.
Lots of slow traffic for your afternoon commute. Going west, the H1 slows at the east end of the airport viaduct. The Moanalua is backed up to Middle Street. It's going to be slow from those spots all the way through Pearl City. Kamehameha Highway, not a good alternative. It's backed up to Hickam, and it's slow all the way around through Pearl Ridge and through Pearl City. Going windward, got an accident reported now on the Pali Highway at Castle Junction.
Want to go green for your home or business? Hawaii Community Reinvestment Corporation introduces its new Green Sun Hawaii program, an innovative public-private partnership to make energy improvements affordable for everyone. Green Sun Hawaii gives you the power to significantly reduce your utility bill. Visit Hawaii National Bank or other participating lenders or one of the many authorized energy contractors for more information. Or visit greensunhawaii.com and click on the easy-to-use loan application.
Aloha, this is a solar daughter, Lena Davis. My dad, the solar guy, Jeff Davis, has been telling me to listen to him my whole life. It's helped me, and I'm sure it'll help you too. Be sure to listen to My Dad, the Solar Guy, 5 to 6 p.m. Monday through Friday on 760 KGU. Aloha!
Aloha! This is the solar guy, Jeff Davis. The solar industry has changed enormously in the last 3 years. So many companies have entered the market that one of the most asked questions I hear is, what makes your company different? Solar Services Hawaii has been serving Oahu and neighbor islands for more than 20 years. Solar Services was awarded the best inspection rate statewide from the Hot Water Rebate Program. We were number one. Solar Services is a local family company. We recognize the need for service with Aloha. I personally have given a class for the IRS. I've lectured many, including two luncheons with the National Association of Tax Preparers. Roof penetration and tax issues are my focus. For all solar products, meaning hot water, photovoltaic, pool and spa heating, solar pool pumps, solar attic fans, you name it. We specialize in photovoltaics and hot water, and of course a free estimate is available. Just call my phone, Jeff Davis the Solar Guy, at 554-7200. That's 554-7200. You have a great day and aloha.
This is Chief Louis Kealoha of the Honolulu Police Department. As part of the HPD's Safer Roads program, our officers are enforcing traffic laws 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. But we need your help. A few common sense choices can make a big difference. Stay within posted speed limits, use a hands-free cell phone device when driving, look out for pedestrians, and have a designated driver if you drink. Together, we can make Oahu's road safer and save lives. Aloha.
If you would like to join Jeff Davis and his guests on the air, call now at 296-5467. That's 296-5467. Now back to the Solar Guy.
You're listening to Hawaii's Tomorrow with Jeff Davis, the Solar Guy.
Welcome back. I'm Carly, the Marine Science Gal, and with me now are Dr. Lars Beiter and Dr. Dave Johnston. Dr. Beiter is the head of Murdoch University Cetacean Research Unit and has extensively studied various aspects of whale and dolphin biology, ecology, and conservation in New Zealand, Australia, and the United States. Dr. Johnston is a research scientist at the Duke University Marine Lab in the Marine Science and Conservation Division of Nicholas School of the Environment. I am so pleased to have you both here today. It is quite the honor to have you both. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
So you guys have been working really hard on spinner dolphins and looking at the population, but more put into context, the spinner dolphin swim tourism. And marine tourism here in Hawaii is a huge industry, bringing in over $7 billion annually. And tourism impact on our marine resources can be an issue of concern. So tell us, how does marine tourism and spinner dolphins relate to what you guys are doing?
Thanks, Carly. I think in general, tourism and marine tourism has massive potential both for conservation and general education of the public. Unfortunately, there are some negative sides to these kinds of activities if they're not properly managed. And I guess we are trying to ensure that it doesn't go that way here in Hawaii. There's certainly a lot of lessons we've learned overseas, elsewhere. And in certain scenarios, we have seen detrimental effects of, to use a popular slogan, loving these animals to death. And that's what we're trying to work with NOAA on here is to prevent some of these things happening.
So how does that contrast, Lars, coming from Australia and working over there? They have federally mandated dolphin tourism or dolphin interactions. How does that differ from what's going on here in Hawaii?
Right. So we have a different legislative framework in Australia where if you have a commercial venture, you need a permit from the state or the federal government to carry out dolphin swims or dolphin watching tours, where here in the U.S. it's a different system where everybody has to follow the rules of the Marine Mammal Protection Act. So it doesn't make a distinguish or a difference between the general public or a commercial operation. So in the situation of the Australian system, it allows for some kind of regulation and I guess a bit more protection on the animals, in that you can set certain levels of number of interactions, the duration of interactions with certain animals. So there are some of the basic differences between here and Australia and also in New Zealand.
And so looking at the population in the context of tourism, Dave, can you tell us a little bit about the Sapphire Project and what was the impetus to get that going?
So the Sapphire Project is a joint project between Duke University and Murdoch University. And Sapphire stands for the Spinner Dolphin Acoustics, Population Parameters, and Human Impacts Research Project. One of the primary goals for our project is to try and estimate the abundance of spinner dolphins, in this case, particularly on the Kona Coast right now. And you can think about that in terms of tourism and trying to understand what sustainability might be. For a lot of businesses, people want to know how much they can take from the land at a certain time. And people often won't invest in businesses unless they know what the output can be. In the case of spinner dolphins, we don't even know how many there are. And so it's really important for us to be able to conduct this research to understand how many there are, and that will help us set some limits on how we use them.
So how do you find out what a population is for a dolphin that moves up and down the coastline? I mean, that's got to be kind of difficult to do.
It is. And, you know, these animals can be very elusive. They spend a lot of the time under the water, so we don't see them all the time. The one thing that's really nice about spinner dolphins is that they have fins that have nicks and notches that will make them identifiable. And by going out and taking photographs of those animals, we can periodically capture them photographically and recapture them photographically later on. And using some not-so-arcane statistics actually estimate the abundance of animals in a certain area. In this case, the area that we're working in coincides with the stock that NOAA has designated using genetics, which we talked about a little bit earlier.
So just to paint a picture for our listeners, basically what you guys are doing is going out there in the boats, taking some pictures of the dorsal fins of the spinner dolphins and matching those to get an estimate of the population and basically find out individuals.
Yeah, that's correct. It sounds pretty straightforward, and when you think about it, it really is. However, there are so many difficulties in studying these highly mobile animals. It does take a lot of time to be able to capture the whole population as such. This particular project has been running for about 2.5 years, and we are starting to get to a stage now where we feel we can get to a pretty accurate estimate of how many animals there are. I guess historically there have been some ballpark figures of how many animals have been using that piece of coastline. Unfortunately, none of these projects have focused particularly on answering how many there are. They have concentrated on the biology and ecology of the animals, but not particularly on figuring out how many there are. That's one of our prime objectives in trying to quantify what might be sustainable or might not be sustainable on this population.
Well, this is no small feat for everyone on your team. I mean, sitting and trying to match those dorsal IDs, well, sounds very easy, is a very time-consuming process. I mean, it is a very difficult thing to do. You guys are also not just looking at dorsal IDs, but you're also listening and doing a bunch of other type of research to get a better understanding of the behavior of the spinner dolphins and how they're affected by everything else that's going on around them in the water. Can you elaborate a little on that?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the techniques that is increasingly used now for studying marine mammals is passive acoustics, or basically listening to them, listen to the sounds they make underwater. Sound is a really important mode of communication for these animals, and so they tend to produce a lot of different sounds at different times, and we can actually start to understand whether they're present in a location and even infer a little bit about what they're doing by the sounds that they make. And so we've had underwater recorders in four bays on the Kona Coast now for 2.5 years, recording essentially day and night the sounds that spinner dolphins make when they're actually in those bays.
And not to put you on the spot, Dave, but what do those sounds sound like?
Well, they make a lot of clicking noises, not so much in the bays, and they spend a lot of time whistling. Things like that.
That's actually a very accurate representation there. So you also do some hiking with your research. You guys, there's a third piece to this, and what does that entail?
So we carry out what's called theodolite tracking. When I say we should talk about Julian Tyne, who's a PhD student carrying out the bulk of this work. Julian and his team use a surveyor's instrument. Many of you will know what that is. When you're driving on the road, you see surveyors. They have this piece of equipment that's basically measuring angles. This piece of equipment, tied together with some software, will allow you to track animals in the nearshore environment and look at their general movement patterns. And you can combine that with some behavioral sampling to look at behavioral states at the same time. This kind of information will allow you to compare how animals behave when they are in their natural state with no disturbance factors in the vicinity, and you can then compare how these movement patterns and behavioral patterns are when there are disturbance factors there. And all of this will help us evaluate how animals respond, both in the short term using these techniques, but also in the long term using the abundance and movement patterns between bays, to see whether we're having impacts on these animals. I guess one point we should talk a little bit about is the daily patterns of these animals. Spinner dolphins live in a very rigid behavioral pattern, unlike many other dolphin species. Spinner dolphins come into these resting bays in the shallow environment, in protected bays, to basically rest and socialize for about 10 to 12 hours a day. These habitats are also the habitats where we as humans like to go for the same reasons. They're protected, they have sandy bottoms, there's little waves, and that brings in I guess overlap between the way humans use these bays and the way the animals use the bays. So these dolphins spend about 10 to 12 hours there, resting and socializing, and then at the end of the day they head offshore and spend the next 10 to 12 hours foraging offshore on the deep scattering layer that comes up to the surface at night. So there's not much room for change for these animals. Unlike other well-studied dolphin species, for example, the bottlenose dolphins, they live in a system where they can go straight from foraging to resting to socializing to foraging 24 hours a day, which means that they're probably less prone to being disturbed. So when we're looking at the spinner dolphins, they don't have that much flexibility in the way that they can respond to potential human disturbances. And that's why we are particularly concerned about their behavioral patterns and human activities.
Well, I can certainly understand needing a routine, and I relate to that with the spinner dolphins. But I think it's important to talk a little bit more about why you chose this particular areas that you're doing your research in. So let's get back to that after traffic break. Let's take a quick traffic break here and acknowledge some of our sponsors: Hawaii Nanotech Glass Coating, Focused Energy, Hawaiian Legacy Hardwares, Tom Moffitt Productions, Island Cooling. Save money on your electricity bill with their quiet whole house fans.
KGU,
part of the Wall Street Business Network.
In Kalihi, we had an accident on Nimitz at Mokauea, and the traffic lights are also reported to be out there, so use caution. Another accident on the windward side on the Pali Highway at Castle Junction, and that's got the Pali backed up before the tunnels. No problems on the Likei-Likei or the H3. Our other slow spots right now, the H1 Evabound all the way through town, and both freeways going west to the stadium are very slow today.
Aloha, it's your solar guy, Jeff Davis, with a sure bet for you and your family. If you or someone you know believes they are living in a neighborhood that has no room on the grid to install more photovoltaics to erase your electricity bill, I can do it. I will guarantee to get your home approved by HECO, or I'll give you $100. Again, if you need PV on your home and you're under the impression that your neighborhood or your grid is full to saturation, I, Jeff Davis, the solar guy, can get your home installed and connected to HECO's net metering program, or I'll give you a $100 call-off bill. You just call me, the solar guy, Jeff Davis, at 554-7200, 554-7200. Aloha.
If you would like to contact Jeff either about the program or have any other questions about solar photovoltaics or hot water, call 554-7200. That's 554-7200.
If you would like to join Jeff Davis and his guests on the air, call now at 296-5467. That's 296-5467. Now back to the Solar Guy.
You're listening to Hawaii's Tomorrow with Jeff Davis, the Solar Guy.
Welcome back. With me now is Dr. David Johnston and Lars Beider talking about spinner dolphins. So we just established that spinner dolphins are creatures of routine. They like to come rest in the bays, shallow bays along the Kona coastline. But we have spinner dolphins elsewhere in Hawaii. Why did you both decide to choose working with the dolphins on the Big Island versus elsewhere?
Well, as people in Hawaii know, the Kona coastline is a pretty special place, and it's actually the place where spinner dolphins have been studied the longest. Ken Norris, a sort of pioneer marine mammal researcher, studied spinner dolphins on the Kona coast in the 1980s, and at one point in time, when Ken and his colleagues were finishing their work there, spinner dolphins were probably one of the best studied small cetaceans, small whales on the planet. Maybe arguably the bottlenose dolphin, a little bit better known. So we knew a lot about those animals. Unfortunately, since that time, we've seemed to lost the thread of spinner dolphin biology, and in many ways, and certainly in terms of their abundance and their population parameters. And so this place is a really great place because it has a great history and a lot of accessibility to the animals in these particular bays. The other side of the coin is that it's also a place where we see the most intense interactions between people and dolphins. And so we have great concern for that particular stock because of the intensity and the consistency of the interactions between people and the dolphins there.
And you guys have identified, or previous studies have identified, that that stock in Kona, or the Big Island, is separate from some of the other stocks within the Hawaiian archipelago, because we see spinner dolphins elsewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. So despite the fact that on a nice clear day you can see across to the other islands, these animals show a lot of fidelity to locations. And the genetic work revealed to us the fact that these animals do spend most of their time in particular locations, and that they don't breed with animals from other islands. There's very little movement amongst these places.
Despite the little movement, though, you talk to a lot of the boat captains, or you talk to a lot of people that are out on the water a lot, and they'll say that the spinner dolphins along the Kona coastline, there are separate groups from the north and the south, but they'll sometimes come together, or they'll mix up. Can you shed a little bit of light on that, or how much truth is there to that?
No, I think it's right. The animals that are found off the Kona coast, certainly some of them do prefer some areas, but in general, what we're finding is that the animals we're finding and identifying down south are found way up north. So through this photo identification work, we're not seeing that that they're confined to specific areas. They do use the entire coastline. And again, through this photo identification work, it does seem like we've reached a plateau in how many animals are there. I think from my perspective, when I originally got here, I had a view that, my gosh, there must be so many animals there, because you come across groups of maybe 200 individuals. And if you look at that and then you try to extrapolate that down the coastline, you might think there's thousands and thousands of these animals, but in fact, it's the same animals that we're coming across again and again and again. The reason why we're finding these large group sizes is because we know where to go look for them. It's in these really important areas. So I guess part of what I've learned here is even though we think there's a lot of animals out there and thousands, our preliminary results are actually showing that there's far less than what we thought. Tying that together with the recent genetic results that these animals don't move to the other islands and they are separate stocks, and that is causing some concerns.
And now you're beginning to work on publishing your results together, both with Julian Tyne. What conclusions can you make, or what numbers are you seeing in terms of population estimates for the spinner dolphins?
The final numbers are still being worked on, but I guess we can say that they are lower than what has previously been thought. We still have to do a little bit more statistics with colleagues of ours, but a bit less than what we thought of previously.
So once you identify what the population numbers are, and if they are indeed declining, what are the next steps? What do you do with this information?
so I think the results will be very useful for management, and in fact, the reason that we're doing our research is because of these management needs. We'll publish the results and pass them on to the agencies here, NOAA, in the state, and I think they'll be really helpful for them in their quest to provide sustainability for those animals in Hawaii. So based on those numbers, they can move forward more confidently with any planned measures to protect the resting habitats.
And so how does this all relate to the Marine Mammal Protection Act? You guys are looking at the population. There is a significant economic incentive here. There's a significant tourism group that works around the spinner dolphins. What does this all mean for the future of the spinner dolphin?
Well, so the management regime requires that NOAA enumerate all stocks of marine mammals in U.S. waters, and we've got a NOAA person here. She can elaborate more on that if need be. So this is a first step, you know, in actually getting the job done for spinner dolphins in Hawaii. And so I think that's that type of approach needs to be then transferred to the other islands. We can start enumerating the other stocks of spinner dolphins in Hawaii, and that will really help NOAA achieve its mandate in enumerating all these stocks.
And Dave, you're really good at making your research available to the public. I know you do a lot of technology and education apps. If the public wants to know more about this particular study or about spinner dolphins, where can they go to get more information?
Well, we have a website at Duke and at Murdoch that that houses a lot of information, updates from the project, those kinds of things. And I haven't got the URL in front of me right now, but it's if you Google Duke spinner dolphins, it will show up. Or if you Google Murdoch University and spinner dolphins, you'll get led to the right place. One of the other things that we have is an interactive timeline that people can go and actually kind of see the chronology of events in Hawaii that have led to what we know about spinner dolphins in terms of the science and management and even cultural significance. And I think you can get to most of those things through the spinnerdolphin.net URL.
That's really interesting. I wasn't even aware of that. I'm definitely going to check that out. And so what final thoughts or advice do you have for the public that are interested in spinner dolphins or would like to help protect spinner dolphins?
Well, my advice is to enjoy them, but do it in a way that's respectful and in a way that it will allow everyone who would like to be able to do that in perpetuity.
I guess on a ending note, one thing that I found very interesting is that if you look at the revenues that from marine tourism in general, where whale and dolphin watching is a major factor of that, but marine tourism brings in more money than fisheries and aquaculture combined in the whole world. So obviously it's a massive industry where whale and dolphin is a major part of that, but we have to make sure that we don't kill the goose that lays the golden egg here. So again, it's all about long-term sustainability for the long-term gain. So like Dave said, enjoy these animals, but let's do it in a sustainable manner.
And maybe you gentlemen can help me before we end the show today. Every person that I've talked to along the Kona Coast or out there watching the spinner dolphins always wants to know, why do they spin? And it's many different responses to this question, but in your scientific opinions, can you give us an answer for why the spinner dolphin spins?
Well, if you look over long term and through evolution, it's probably a combination of the two things that people usually think. Originally, it's probably to remove the remoras that are attached to their bodies.
And what are remoras for our listeners?
So they're parasitic fish that sit on and clean and feed off the skin of spinner dolphins. So by jumping in there and spinning and landing, you can remove these. But as that has evolved through time, it's probably also evolved into a communication system in that when these animals land on the water, it portrays or it communicates to the other animals sounds, and that can convey a behavioral state or an intent. So it's probably a combination of trying to remove these remoras, but also communication.
So they're not putting on a circus show for the spectators then?
Not in my mind.
Okay. Well, thank you both for being on the show today. This is amazing work, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what comes out of the research you've been doing, and thank you for sharing your knowledge with us. Today we have heard from many of a few of the marine mammal heroes. There are many here in Hawaii, but the guests or panel that we've had here today are particularly amazing folks working to study and protect Hawaii's marine mammal populations, from spinner dolphins to false killer whales to monk seals. I would like to give a special thank you to all of our guests who took time out of their busy schedule